Okay, so I hope you had a nice break. Turns out the exams aren't graded yet, so we'll try to get those to you Tuesday. Sorry about that. I sent out an email to you about this end of semester sort of project thing. And a reminder is that the whole point of that is to be able to explore a few things that we're not going to talk about in lecture, but to also allow you to try to pick some things that you're interested in. And I didn't get any additions to the list, so what I'm going to do, I mean, you can take the list that I already sent you. I may send it again, it will be the same thing. And what I'd like you to do is to basically look at the topics and then rank order, one being the one that you would be most interested in learning something about and maybe presenting to the class. And, you know, give me, like, your top five and rank order them. And then what I'll do is I'll try to get fairly even size groupings where I will give you as high a number or as low a number as I can, so one that you most prefer. Okay? Yes?
How would you want to just fill out an email or written?
Let's do written. Yeah, because otherwise I'll just get drawn to the email and I'll come up and slip through. So let's do written. You can certainly hand it to me in class next Tuesday, and I'll probably also set up a folder or something outside my office, or you can put it there. Okay, and then hopefully once I get those together on Tuesday, I'll set up projects and try to assign you to your group on before Thursday. Okay, and the whole idea is you guys get together and learn about this topic, and then try to present a 20-minute something to the class via some form that works for you. If you want to do it, and I guess that's okay. But, you know, and you want to make it reasonable, so accessible, entertaining if you wish. But it, you know, it has to have some content. And I'm hoping you'll actually have fun with it.
It's just testing it so it has power.
Oh yeah, that would be a drag if we didn't have power there. Okay. Anyway, so any questions right now on the project? Okay. Before we get into Kirchhoff's rules again, let's think about it. Suppose that I have a big EMF, and let's say that I have this EMF connected to a couple of big conductors, and across those conductors I put two resistors. Let's just say that these resistors are also conductors, but they have some resistance to them. And one of them, they're identical. And I chose poor colors, so let me try again. They're basically nails, one of which is long, one of which is short. They're identical nails. Okay? And I have a potent power source. So what I have is two big conducting bars, a short nail that connects the two bars, and a long nail that connects the two bars, the nails being identical in terms of cross-section and material. Okay? So now, I put a huge EMF across them. What happens?
I'll move across the short end.
What goes across the short nail?
The current.
And then what happens?
The nail heats up.
Yeah, the nail heats up. It's almost explosive, actually. So, because it's a pretty good power source. All right. So, you think it's the short nail or the long nail that goes kablooey? That's the question. Why? What do you think? Which one has the larger resistance? The long one has the larger resistance because it's the same thing, it's just longer, so you have to fight your way through more, okay? The potential is the same across both of them, so the current is going to be greater across the short one. And power goes as I squared R. R goes as V over I. So let's think about this. Okay, so L is long, S is short. Okay? So power is equal to V times I, same as I squared over R. All right, so V doesn't change, so it goes as current, and you've got smaller resistance here, so you're going to have a larger current. So we think the short one's going to blow. You good with that? All right, let's see what happens. Short one, long one. So they both go, but the short one went first, right? Ta-da! All right. Physics works. I don't know why it is, but I'm always relieved when physics works. It's a little bit... It's a real drag when demos do the opposite of what you think they ought to do when you're in front of people. Not good. All right, so last time we talked a bit about Kirchhoff's rules, and I think you have problems due Friday that involve doing some of these. So basically, regardless of how complicated the circuit is, you have a little bit of physics that drives it. One is that you have current conservation at each intersection, and the other is for any closed loop around that you choose to go around the circuit, the sum of all the potential drops and additions has to be zero because you're coming back to the same place. So the net work you do to leave that point and come back to that point has to be zero because it's single value at that point, right? The potential can only be what it is at that point. So to solve these things, what you do is you have to assign the currents if they're not already given to you. And by that, I mean you choose which direction and label them in all the various segments of the circuit in which they could currently be flowing. Then you select independent loops, and so that means each mental loop you choose to do in the circuit has to have at least a segment which is not shared by the other loops that you're choosing. And you can generally Generally, it also corresponds to the number of topological loops that you have in the circuit. It's not always easy to see that, but that's generally the case. And then you get sets of equations that correspond to current conservation at each junction. But again, you need to have independence in mind. So you can have a lot of currents, and often, if you're not careful, you'll sort of get to the end and you'll be making up equations that you basically already have that information in earlier equations. So be a little careful with that. And then for each, you then choose loops, and then you mentally sort of assign whatever they are. And then you can make up an equation which corresponds to the sum of the voltages around that loop and set it equal to zero. And when you do that, you have to be very careful with conventions. And the conventions that we are using if you traverse in your loop, this is independent of how the current is actually going, that you mentally decide, okay, I'm going to go clockwise or counterclockwise around this loop. As you mentally traverse that loop, as you're doing the sum, if you are going across a resistor in the direction of the current, it comes in with a minus IR. If you're going in the direction against the current, it's a plus IR. If you go with the EMF, that is, you go from negative to positive, then it comes in with a positive sign. And if you go against it, it comes in with a negative sign. And you just have to be very consistent and very careful. If you are an ECE 210 or whatever, if you use the opposite convention, it also works just fine, but you better be very consistent about it. Also, if you intend to flip all the signs in this convention, I would like you to say that whenever you're doing a problem for an exam or whatever, so the grader is at least aware of that. I mean, I have no idea what I'll ask you that may pull this out, but one of the things the grader will often be looking for is, do you have the conventions right at least, you know, are you doing it? So if you're going to flip conventions, you need to at least let us know. So once you do this carefully, then you have a system of n equations and n unknowns, and if the circuit is small enough, it's analytically solvable. Okay, and I think the basic ideas here would form the basis of any sort of computational solution to a circuit as well, because that's the basic physics that's involved. So any questions on this? Okay, so these can be pretty tedious. I mean, these can be a lot of fun. So enjoy. So then, also last time we began to look at what happens if you start combining put capacitors in the circuit. And so if you want to think about this circuit, then we have two things that can happen depending on which direction the switch is going. If the switch connects to A, then what you have is the EMF basically sending charge until the capacitor is charged to the point that the voltage across the capacitor is equal and opposite to that of the EMF, so that basically then the charge won't flow. So that's the steady state. We sort of thought about capacitors, whether they're charged or they're not. But I'd like to look at the time dependence now. And so to do that, basically, even if it's time dependent, at any given time, you still have to worry about the voltage drop. It's just in this case, the voltage may be changing as the charge in the capacitor gets built up. So if we think of this loop and we do a voltage sum mentally or clockwise around this loop, then 0 is equal to the EMF minus IR minus Q over C, which is the voltage drop across the capacitor. Okay? And so this is an equation. So this is the voltage across the resistor, voltage across the capacitor. And it's time dependent because the current is the change in the charge with respect to time. So it's a differential equation, and this is not a differential equation, it's class, but this is a soluble, simple differential equation. And when you solve for Q, this is the solution you get, okay, where this is the capacitance, this is the value of the EMF, and it's 1 minus the E to the minus T over RC power. All right, so what I'd like to do is to look at this and try to understand what this is telling us physically for a moment. So let's look at the different components. First of all, just to get a feeling for it, remember that e to the x goes like that. So e to the minus x goes like that. If we have e to the minus t over rc, what it tells you is you reach a value which is e to the minus 1 when t is equal to rc. So what that means is this quantity RC is sort of governing how fast this quantity falls off with time. Okay? And then if we look at that wrong. If we do 1 minus e to the minus t over rc, then what we're doing is as we go out in time, we're subtracting less and less. So this looks like that. So it asymptotically approaches e to t minus r to c. So those are sort of the various components. So let's look and see what that really gives us in the end. So we plot as a function of time. Instead of 1, we've now multiplied by this quantity times e, which q is equal to cd. So if you have no time dependence, or if you go to infinite time, q is equal to cv. So that tells you the asymptotic amount of charge that you get up on the thing. So instead of rising to 1, it rises to c epsilon. You start out with zero charge, and it rises and asymptotically approaches the value C times epsilon. So if RC is small, if this is small, then this falls off faster. If RC is big, then it falls off slower. If you have a short time constant, we call it, so so the exponential e to the minus whatever, this whatever has its unitless. So the RC, the quantity RC, sort of dictates the time structure. And it rises has this exponential depending on how large this RC is. We have the T over RC. So we define RC as the time constant of the circuit. So you can define how the thing behaves in time by sort of choosing the right RC combination. Okay? And we actually have that going in front of you. I think you'll do a lab. Have you done the lab already? Okay, you're going to do a lab soon, which I think has this particular setup. So to study something that has time dependence, very often it's not so great just to put a voltage across something and look at it once. So what's often done is you use the oscilloscope and a power supply, where the power supply basically gives you a square wave, which is a DC voltage of a certain value, but then it flips it. So it's a strange sort of alternating thing. So the voltage that you get would look like this across whatever the circuit is. And that sort of allows you to repeatedly look at how the circuit behaves with a DC voltage across it. But of course, this whole thing is sort of happening in some weird AC way. But that's basically what we're looking at here. So let's forget what's going on over here. Let's forget what's going on here for the moment. Let's suppose that T equals 0 is right here. This line corresponds to the voltage that I'm putting across a resistor and a capacitor. And if you look at, and then what we're measuring is the voltage across the capacitor itself, okay, which the term is determined by how much charge is on that capacitor. So this effectively is looking at how the charge is changing with respect to time, okay? And so this is the voltage across the resistor, basically. So that's the voltage that you're putting across the thing. And then this would be the voltage across the capacitor, and what you see is that at T equals 0, you start with a fixed voltage across the circuit, and the voltage across the capacitor, that is the charge, is growing exponentially as a function of time. And it asymptotically approaches CV right there. And if I increase the resistance or the capacitance, look at what happens. So I'm going to say increase the resistor. I'll need to do a bigger one. I'll increase it a lot. Okay, so if I increase R, I'm changing the time constant, so it's charging up slowly. And actually, it now is charging up so slowly it doesn't reach the asymptotic value by the time that the power supply flips the sign. If I increase the capacitance, you get the same type of behavior. Okay, so if I decrease the resistance, you can see that I get a shorter time constant that charges up much more quickly. Okay? So that's what we're looking at. And this piece is what happens when you have the empty capacitor and resistor and you just put the voltage across it and it charges it up. Okay? So basically, we just looked at that piece. So now what I'd like to do is to look at the same thing, but to take that circuit and flip the switch the other way. So what we just looked at is where you have taken this RMC and you put it across the EMF. And now what I'd like to do is to say, all right, I have allowed that to happen. The charge has flowed. We now have reached an asymptotic charge on the capacitor, so it's fully charged. And now I flip the switch down. And when I do that, I'm effectively shorting the capacitor across the resistor. And let's look at that. Well, I'm not effectively shorting, I am shorting. Okay. So that's now our circuit. If we choose this as our loop, and let's say that the current is going this way, we can say that the sum of the voltages is equal to zero. So as we go around, minus IR minus Q over C is equal to zero. Or minus dQ over dt times R is equal to Q over C. We can integrate both sides. Let me pull the... Let's say that I have... pull the dt over... So I can pull the Q down, so I have minus dQ over Q on the one side, and then I will have 1 over RC times the integral of dt on the other side. And I will be going from Q0, which is the amount of charge I have when it's fully charged, to whatever value Q I have at some time t, and I go from 0 to t. All right, so the integral of dt is just t. So this becomes t over rc. The left-hand side becomes minus the natural log of q over q0. So we have that the natural log, we have... Q is equal to Q0 e to the minus t over RC as a solution to that one. So I just pull the minus sign over, I take the natural log of both sides, that leaves me with Q over Q0 on the left side and e to the minus t over RC on the right side, and I pull the Q0 over. So this tells you that the amount of charge on the capacitor is going to fall off, again, exponentially with time. If RC is big, it takes a long time. If RC is small, it takes a short time. And it drops from its initial value of fully charged down to some value of time t exponentially. So if you look now, here we have the capacitor fully charged. And now we flip the sign on the voltage, which is not quite what we're talking about here, but basically what you'll see is that the charge now flows off in an exponential sort of way. So that's not exactly what we're talking about here, but it's fairly close. Since we have the initial charge is CV, then we have for this so the initial charge will start at value of C epsilon and then it will fall off to zero with an exponential time dependence. And if RC is small, it falls off very fast. And if RC is large, it'll fall off slower. Okay? So you guys good with that?
Yeah.
All right, so you can, I hope, begin to imagine how you can be, create a very rich situation with combinations of different circuit elements. We're going to have a lot more fun with this later as we add in some magnetism things that are possible effects. And then we'll look at what happens when you have alternating current with yet another component, and then it becomes a lot richer. But, so I'm going to drop this for right now. Any questions? Okay. So this may seem a little disjoint, but I'm going to take a break right now from electromagnetism, and I'm going to talk a little while. We're going to do a little bit of relativity. And when we're done with what we're going to do in relativity, we'll come back to electricity, and you'll then understand why I'm worrying about relativity right now. What I want to start with are just very conceptual slides, which I happen to have prepared for seventh grade classes, usually. But the concepts are still the concepts. I'm going to start with that, but I apologize because it's sort of dark, these slides, so let me turn that down a little bit. All right. What's space? Space is the fabric in which we measure where something is a way to say it. Okay, so how many dimensions of space do we live in? What do we mean by dimensions? We live in three spatial dimensions. How do I know that? Because it takes three numbers to specify where something is.
X, Y, Z.
X, Y, Z, R, theta, phi. You go to the grocery store, where are the corn nuts? Third aisle, halfway down, second shelf up. Right? There is another dimension to things, which is time, because the corn nuts were there yesterday, but they're not today. Okay? So that space, you know, we mentioned the T word, so what is time?
Everything.
You guys don't sit around thinking about this shit? What?
The fabric which we determine when.
Okay.
As opposed to where.
I guess, whatever you mean by when. Let me think about this a different way. How exciting would this class be if time didn't exist? How do you know time has to exist?
Because things change.
Because things change. We live in a universe where things change, and time is what we require in order to sort of quantify or order that and be aware of it. Yeah.
But can things change as a result of the change in location?
This is yeah, but it's a change in location in time.
I mean, it doesn't have to be, right?
I don't know. What do you mean by a change in location is you don't have a concept of time? All right. Okay, so space and time. It's really not so complicated because, in fact, we have a pretty firm idea of what we mean by space and time. So, even the simplest way to think about it might be something that combines space and time, which might be just let's measure something that is in motion. So, you know, if I go jogging past you and you have some sort of device that can measure my speed, let's say that I go jogging past you at 4 miles per hour. All right, and you measure that. And then let's say that we're doing this, but we're in the Chicago airport and there's a moving sidewalk, okay? And I go jogging past and I'm jogging at 4 miles per hour. The moving sidewalk is moving at 2 miles per hour. And I'm on the moving sidewalk, but I didn't break stride. And you measure my speed and you're off to the side. How fast am I going?
Six.
No argument, right? So velocities are additive, and we all understand this. No big deal. Okay, so let me come back to this before we move on. We all have, well, let me ask you, what is your big vision of how space and time are related? You must have a big vision of it, right? Because you're now in your second year from the Bachelor of Physics in the university level. You're dealing with space and time all the time. How does it all fit together? How is your vision compared to her vision? It could be a very scary thing, I don't know. But I can guess. If we distribute watches and we all set our watches to the exact specific time, whatever it is, let's say they're nice atomic watches, and then we just disperse and go off and do our thing for a few days and come back. If we agree on the time, we all try to walk through the door at the exact same time. Right? That's the world in which we live. So your vision of space and time is very ingrained. We live in three immutable, infinite spatial dimensions that we all perceive to be the same, that effectively moves at a constant rate through time in one direction. Right? Note that I did not say biological time. Because if I'm boring the crap out of you, this class can go on forever. Okay, I totally get that. Okay, you're having a great time, you're out with your friends, it just seems to go back to the guest. So that's a different sort of perception. I'm talking about literal clock time. Okay. All right. So that's the world in which we all live. We all have that same vision. And it turns out that it's pretty important because things like relative velocity are very important. All right. Can you imagine how strange it would be to drive on the interstate if relative velocity didn't work? Or if you were around people who didn't share your concept of relative velocity, it could be really strange. So Newtonian mechanics is built on this vision of space and time that we all agree is the thing that we use every day. And it works really well. That's why Newtonian mechanics works really well. That's why when you lob a mortar shell, you get what you're after if you aim it right. And if you are driving a car, you can safely figure out, you know, how to pass and things like that. So this is Newtonian mechanics. If you want to go kill a deer to survive and eat, it's Newtonian mechanics, basically. That's our intuition. All right? We evolved with that being our intuition. All right. So, happily, the universe is not so limited. So let's think of what would happen if we take our example with the moving sidewalk, but we're going to change it a little bit. Let's say now I'm in a car and I'm driving and I have a laser beam that shoots a pulse of light out in the direction I'm driving, or straight up or backwards. Okay? And you now measure the speed of the light with some weird device. What would you now see? But that makes no sense. Because what you just said was, I'm on this moving sidewalk, you measure exactly the same speed as you would if I was going the other way in the moving sidewalk, or I never got on the moving sidewalk at all. We're going to get ahead of ourselves, but light is a wave phenomenon, okay? Water waves travel at a certain velocity on water. If I throw a rock in a pond, and I'm looking at the speed of the waves emanating away from that rock, and I now run, I can run the same speed as those waves, so that their speed with respect to me is zero, right? Okay, so getting ahead of ourselves, what we'll find is that light is a wave phenomenon, and that's a pretty absolute hard core statement. There's no doubt that light is a wave phenomenon. Okay. So all the other wave phenomena that we know about require a medium in which they travel, and they travel at a fixed velocity. If that's true, your velocity can vary, so you should be able to see variation in that. Okay, so that is something that is in agreement with everything else that you hold dear and true. And then it turns out that if you go and you do this measurement, what you find is that the light seems to travel the same speed with respect to you, regardless of which reference frame it's in, regardless of whether you're looking at it that way, this way, or that way. Now, that's no surprise to you because you've grown up hearing it all your lives. But what I want to sort of impress upon you is how absolutely absurd that is. Okay? Because it is an absolute contradiction to everything else that you hold dear, that you operate with in the world that you're in. Okay? And to sort of impress upon you how absolutely ridiculous that is, what we'll do is we'll take this silly, silly experimental fact, and we will assume it to be true, and we'll see how ridiculous it shows things to be. All right, so, So let us assume So Einstein has this reputation. He's the intellectual icon, right? He's the famous physicist, right, that everybody knows about. One of the things that I really find fascinating about him is that I'm clearly a smart guy. I'm clearly technically smart, but his real power as a scientist, in my mind, had to do not with his ability to solve complex mathematics, but it had to do with his ability to see the simplicity in things and to just sort of ask the simple questions and pursue them. And so, effectively, he asked, well, if I can perceive the speed of light to be different depending on how I move with respect to it, what does light look like if I'm running at the speed of light? Which is a pretty profound question, okay? Or another way to see it is, what happens if we just assume that the speed of light is the same for all observers regardless of their motion? Why? Not because it makes sense, but because it's an experimental fact. It's been seen to be true, and science operates that way. So let's just pursue it and see what happens. So the starting point for relativity is simply that the velocity of light is the same for all observers and all inertial reference frames. So inertial means that it is not accelerating. Reference frame, basically, you can think of as a coordinate system nailed to your head that defines how you perceive things. You will, at any given moment, regardless of your motion, be able to put things and times. You make an observation, and whenever you make an observation of something is at a certain space or time, you would find that as something in your reference frame. So inertial is that we are only going to consider reference frames that are moving at a constant speed with respect to each other. And then the other thing is again, something very obvious. I mean, this is very obvious if you say, okay, let's believe the experiment and just see what happens, even though it's crazy. This is just obvious, right? It's like whatever happens has to happen, and everybody has to see it happen. So if I take an egg and I drop it and it breaks on the floor, that's sort of a physical fact. We call it the physics of whatever happens in lingo, right? But whether somebody flies by on a jet aircraft or you're standing here right beside it, that egg is now broken, okay? So we say that the physics is the same for all observers. There's also some causality in there. I let the egg go, and then it breaks. So there has to be some preservation of the physics. So those are the only two things we're going to worry about. So let's now do a thought experiment. Let's say that we have a train car going by. The train has a height h, and there's a mirror up here, and you have a light emitter at the bottom, and the light, the physics that we're going to talk about is the light is emitted, goes up to the top, bounces off the mirror, and comes back down. Okay? So that is the fact, and everybody has to agree that that happens. So we want to look at this from two points of view. So the first point of view, let's say Sam, it's always Sam and Fallon in relativity for whatever reason. So let's say we have Sam, who is sitting on the train, right beside this little LED that's emitting the light or whatever. And Sam has a really fabulous stopwatch and amazing reflexes, okay? And so Sam is able to somehow perceive that the light is emitted and detected. So the light goes up, travels a distance h, comes back, traveling a distance h, and Sam finds the time that it takes for it to happen. And if the velocity of light is c, then sort of by how we define that, then it's the distance over time, so it's 2h over the time that he measures. All right? So what I would like to do now is just to compare this observation with that of someone who is beside the train as the train goes by, which we'll call Sally. So Sally is there, and Sally also has fabulous reflexes, and she sees that the light is emitted, starts her stopwatch. Oops, I went the wrong way. In the time that the light travels up to the mirror, the train moves. And in the time it comes back, it moves again. So this is actually what Sally must perceive. because light moves at a finite speed. Okay? And now the geometry is a bit different, but conceptually, you can see that this is a longer pathway. If I demand that the speed of this light be the same in both reference frames, by virtue of this being a longer path length, the time that Sally measures for the exact same event to happen must be longer. The only difference between Sam and Sally is that they're moving with respect to each other. And what we just said is they now have looked at the same event and they measure it to take different amounts of time. So this whole idea of absolute time that we hold religiously in our heart in order to make it to work on time is crap, if you believe this. Okay? So we can look at this a little more carefully, right? This total distance is the velocity of the train times the amount of time that Sally measures. Okay, so it's VT Sally. This height, we know, is H. So this distance is this quantity. So we can do the same calculation we did. If C is the distance over time to D, and D is that weird thing that we just talked about. So here's what we get for Sam for the speed of light. This is now what we have for Sally. It's 2 times that distance D, which is by Pythagorean, this h squared plus 1/2 of the distance the train went squared in terms of Sally's time. That's the distance divided by Sally's time gives you the speed. We say by postulate these are the same. So if you set them equal algebraically and you solve for Sam's time in terms of Sally's time, or vice versa, what you find, Sally's time in terms of Sam's time, is that they are the same except for this weird quantity. Okay? This is a quantity that we call gamma. And this is nothing fancy, it's just a little algebra. Look at this quantity for a moment. If the train is going slow, like any train that we actually know in the real world would go, compared to the speed of light, V over C is a very small quantity. 1 minus a small quantity is 1. Square root of 1 is 1. You have 1 over 1. They measure the same time. That is the world in which we live. Even if you put an F15 at full speed here, that is the world in which it's still going to be, gamma would be 1. But if you begin to consider things like subatomic particles that you can accelerate up to reasonable fractions of the speed of light, or if we someday manage to create something that moves at some large fraction of the speed of light, this number now becomes appreciable compared to 1. 1 minus a number that's sizable then becomes something smaller than 1. Square root of something smaller than 1 is smaller than 1. 1 over something that's smaller than 1 is a bigger number. As V approaches C, this number becomes bigger and bigger and bigger. So as you consider reference frames that are moving with respect to each other at significant fractions of the speed of light, and you ask, what do they measure in terms of time for a certain event? They will measure different times. If the event happens, for example, in Sam's reference frame, Sally will measure a much, much larger time. So, I don't think that is really weird enough. First of all, let's say, you know, is this true, as strange as it sounds? And yeah, you can do experiments. There are general relativistic effects, so that is, there are effects from gravity. We'll talk about that in just a moment. So it's not quite as simple as I'll make it sound right here, but you can take two clocks that are very, very precise. You can synchronize them. You can take one and put it on an airplane and send it around the world and bring it back, and you will find that the clock that was on the airplane, less time has elapsed than the clock that was on the ground. And it agrees with relativity, although you have to do more complicated calculations than what we just did. So it turns out to be true. But I think to make it, to bring it into full glory, I'd like to do an example with you. Let us suppose that here we are on Earth, and when there's a rocket ship that's going by, and let's say the rocket ship is going by 98% the speed of light, and it's at a constant speed. So we have two different inertial frames. And let us say that astronomers notice this rocket ship and they are carefully observing it, and they notice one day that blue balloons go up in a window, and you know it's a boy. Right? So somebody is born on this rocket ship. And let's say that this person then lives 70 happy years, as happy as you can be on stuck on a rocket ship. Right? So 70 happy years on the rocket ship, and then they die, and the astronomers on Earth are watching this stupid rocket ship, and they see, you know, the funeral balloons go up, and they mark down on their calendar when that happened. And so then the question is, 70 years has elapsed, sort of by definition, on the rocket ship. How long did this person live as seen by Earth observers? And if we believe relativity, this is the 70 years. It's actually a special time. It's the proper time because it's the time measured in the system where the event, which is birth and death, happened at rest. So from the point of view of being on the spaceship, you're at rest. Okay, so we call that the proper time. It is the time that's elapsed in the reference frame where this thing happened at rest, the proper frame. That turns out to be the piece that goes over here when you're relating two reference frames. How do I know? This little trick, which is, I know that we have so-called time dilation. That means there is a frame where the time is shortest, and that is the frame where something happens at rest. So the 70 goes over here, that's the time in the spaceship. Then we calculate gamma here, putting in the 0.98c, and we find it's a factor of 5. So in fact, on Earth, 350 years elapsed. So does that bother you? Life was normal on Earth during this time. Life on the spaceship was normal during this time. It's not that on the spaceship everybody goes. That only happens if you ask, what does it look like on Earth? Who's right? They are both right. So I can take you and your twin, leave you on Earth, your twin on the spaceship. It's a little more complicated than this because by virtue of this problem, the spaceship now takes off as the speed of light and comes back, but that involves acceleration, so you necessarily have to involve a little bit more than a special relativity. By the way, this is special relativity. Special means only for inertial reference frames, moving constant rates with respect to each other. So your twin can go off their time gets dilated in this way. Time goes slower for them. When they come back and get out of the spaceship, you may have been dead for 200 years. They may be meeting their great-great-grandchildren. So time travel is really quite practical, but only in one direction. I don't know how to send you backwards, but I can, in principle, send you to the future. All right, so if that's not weird enough, we're going to now look at the length of the boxcar. And again, you sort of have these two points of view, and you can analyze them. If you're on the boxcar, you know your speed, you know your time, you can measure the length. If you're sitting here by the side, you can measure, you know the speed, you know the amount of time, you can also measure the length. Okay. So it turns out that you will get a similar effect. I don't have the algebra here, but what you'll find is that if your speed with respect to something is zero, okay, if I have a ball, for example, it'll look like a ball. If that ball is now traveling past you at a large speed, and you were somehow able to see it, what you will see is that the spatial dimension, if you measure things along the spatial dimension of motion for that object, you'll find that it's shortened. You have length contraction. So quite literally, if the baseball pitcher can throw the ball fast enough and you're off to the side, you would see the ball looking like a pancake. Okay. So not only is time relative, but space is relative. Alright? But all that's changing here is your point of view. How you move with respect to whatever it is you're seeing. And we're looking at how you perceive things from your point of view. So if you can calculate the length thing if you want, you'll find a very similar sort of relationship. But we have length contraction, which means things are longest in their proper frame. That is, if I'm beside the meter stick and it's aggressive with respect to me, I'll measure a meter. If I measure it from any other reference frame, I'll measure something shorter than the meter, and that degree of shortness will be by the factor gamma, which is depends on how fast you're going with respect to it. Of course, events happen both in space and time, so it is a little more complex than the particular example we looked at. So let us imagine that someone measures an event x, y, z, and t in their reference frame, and then somebody else measures the same event, and now we'll say that they're moving with respect to the first frame, and they measure it x prime, y prime, z prime, and t prime. Then it turns out that you can relate the positions and time as measured in one reference frame to that measured in the other reference frame by this series of transformations. These are called Lorentz transformations, and in fact they were known before Einstein, but they weren't really under the essence of them, where they came from really wasn't yet understood. What you find is that the space and the time are both distorted. The spatial, if you're moving along the x, then you have a distortion along x. The transverse dimensions are unchanged, and time is distorted. One of the really fabulous things here that you may notice is that the where in this reference frame depends both on the where and the when in the other reference frame. And the when depends both on the where and the when in the other reference frame. So things that are necessarily simultaneous in one reference frame are not necessarily simultaneous in any other. In fact, they cannot be simultaneous in any other reference frame if they are at different positions. So your whole concept of simultaneity is now thrown out the window. If we all agree, if you're flying past Earth at some speed, and everybody on Earth decides, okay, this Independence Day, everybody's going to set off their fireworks across the country at midnight on July the 4th, and you're flying by, and by midnight East Coast time, so even the West Coasters, they're doing it at 9 p.m., right, instead of midnight. So if you are at rest with respect to Earth, then you're looking at that, what you would see is all of a sudden you'd see fireworks going off across the country, simultaneously. If you're now flying by in a spaceship and you see the same event, you will not see that happen simultaneously because these are all at different places. So the times will all be different for you. And both are true. You can even flip the ordering in time, depending on your reference frame. What you cannot do is flip the ordering in time of things that are causally connected. Because if you could do that, then we could make no sense of any causality would be thrown out to one. All right. So the interesting thing about this, in part, is that in our minds, and what we've grown up with, space and time are very separate things. Here, they get all mixed up. They're not separate at all. So we no longer really talk about space and time, but we have to talk about space-time. Because these transformations sort of mix it up. What you perceive as some sort of separation in space or time in one reference frame gets all mixed up. It depends on both the space and the time if you're looking at it from some other reference frame. All right, so anyway, so we have space-time. Sorry, talk's meant for other things. Okay, so we've talked about space and time, but of course you can measure all sorts of other things. And we need to understand how measurements of anything will depend on your point of view, because in science you need to be able to make measurements, and it's actually absolutely essential part of science is to be able to relate whatever it is that you measure to whatever someone else might measure. And so that includes things, people that are in different reference frames. So, we will come to it, but it turns out that energy and momentum transform in the same way as space and time that we've just measured. They actually have the same transformation rules. And momentum, of course, depends on the mass. So if you sort of combine these transformations, we're going to derive this, but it ends up that what you find is that the energy and mass are different phases of the same thing. So this, of course, is a pretty important thing that allows us to understand the atomic age and how stars work. Okay, so that was in 1905. Einstein had a really big year. His first paper on special relativity really had to do with electricity and magnetism, which is sort of what I'm talking about now. We'll come back to it, and I'll draw how those are tied together. That was one paper he wrote in 1905. Another paper he wrote was energy and momentum, and basically launched the nuclear age. The first one sort of understood electromagnetism in a level that had never been understood before. Then he did a paper on the same year on understanding Brownian motion, which is if you look at pollen in oil under a microscope, it wiggles. And people were trying to understand why it wiggle and how it wiggle, and they were trying to... And it turns out that you can understand that from a statistical mechanics point of view if you think the pollen is being hit by vibrating molecules or atoms. And this was actually the first direct evidence of the existence of the atomic nature of matter. A lot of indirect stuff, but this was a direct observation that you could interpret this way that actually worked. So he wrote a paper on Brownian motion, and then he also wrote a paper where he understood what's called the photoelectric effect, which is if you shine light on a heavy metal, it'll eject electrons. And it doesn't behave at all the way that you would expect it to behave if you were just using classical theory of light that we'll come to understand in this class. And in order to account for the data, he had to assume that the light comes in little packets of energy, which we now call photons or quanta. And this was the second such phenomenon that was explained using light as quanta. Earlier, it had been used to explain what's called the black body radiation, which is basically the spectrum of light that comes off of something as you heat it up. And that also couldn't be understood classically, but Max Planck came up with a formula that described it perfectly, but to make it work, he had to assume light comes in those quanta. But light was very well known to be a wave at that time. So when Einstein came along and explained yet something, so people basically said, okay, Planck's formula works, but he's a nutcase, because of course light's a wave, not a particle. So he got lucky, and no, we don't understand it yet. But then Einstein came along, and his paper, he explained something new with the same idea, and it turns out that the proportionality constant tells you how much energy is in each quantum is the same in each case. So all of a sudden, you had to take the idea of light quanta seriously. So in 1905, we understood electromagnetism, we launched the nuclear age, we have firm evidence for the atomic world, and we launched quantum mechanics. Einstein, by all rights, could have won a Nobel Prize for any of those four papers. It was an amazing year for the guy. So at any rate, then no doubt he did stuff for a while, but he got quiet, and the next thing that you think of about Einstein was general relativity, which he did not publish until about 1914, or 1916, I guess, is when the paper came out. So there's a lot of time involved, and so I guess I'm out of time, so I will stop here. We'll come back to relativity on Tuesday, and we'll talk about the idea of general relativity.